Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Chinese Lunar New Year isn't for another 5 weeks or so, but for businesses in Beijing, Gregorian rules apply, which means it's already 2008 over there, and the Chinese government has raised taxes for the new year. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to the last day of 2007. Everybody, this year it's a Monday, and it's great to have you here. The Chinese government is ringing in the new year by ringing up some new taxes on grain exports. As of January 1st, Beijing Standard Time, wheat growers looking to export their crops have to pony up a 20% tax. The duty on corn and rice has been set at 5%. Until not too long ago, Beijing was giving farmers sizable tax rebates for their grain exports, but food prices in China have been soaring. Not a good thing for a government that's keen to avoid social unrest. And it bodes none too well for the rest of us either, when demand for grain around the world is rapidly outpacing supply. Marketplace's Bob Moon has the story.
China is the world's biggest grain producer, and its harvest over the past year grew quite literally to more than 500 million tons. But it seems there still isn't enough to go around for the country's ever-growing population, so Beijing hopes to keep supplies at home and control rising inflation. Tighter global supplies could put upward pressure on prices, but industry analyst Vic Lespinasse of Illinois Grain says that could be good news for American farmers.
The Chinese, especially in corn, were a big competitor with the U.S. They would export millions of tons of corn every year, taking away some traditional U.S. markets. And to that extent, it will encourage U.S. corn exports. So U.S. farmers welcome this move.
On the other hand, Argentina and Russia are already moving to restrict their grain exports, while other countries have been buying up grain aggressively. Lynn Group analyst Roy Huckabee says it all points to what he calls dangerously short supplies.
If you look at wheat, corn, and rice, and that covers most of your edible grains in the world, we've got about 2 months of supply at the end of the year.
And just like the scramble for oil, a tax on food exports from China now ripples throughout the global economy.
I don't think we ever go back to the cheap prices we had in the 80s and 90s. I think that turning food into fuel has started this. I mean, we saw that tightness coming. So we continue to see this tug of higher prices until we get comfortable with supplies again. And I think that comfort level is probably a couple years away.
Huckabee says with only so much farmland left, achieving that will require the use of new genetic technologies to produce bigger crop yields. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It might not turn out to be a happy new year for employees at the record label EMI. There is word today the label's new owners have decided to clamp down on costs, and job cuts are always in play when management starts talking that way. The private equity firm Terra Firma bought EMI back in September for close to $8 billion. Soon after that, the company lost its best-known band, Radiohead, and its plans to make the company more productive have drawn some fire from critics. Marketplace's Amy Scott takes a closer look.
In the new year, Terra Firma chief Guy Hans will announce his plan for turning EMI around. The Financial Times reports today that a cultural shift is already underway. Music executives have long enjoyed great leeway in signing and promoting new artists. Now they'll have to draw up business plans and get management approval. Music writer Michael Azarad thinks it's a great idea.
Guy Hans wants to run a profitable business. And if that means changing some very dearly held old conventions like lavish expense accounts and signing artists willy-nilly and not really having a plan about how you're going to promote them and things like that, well, you know, that's all got to go.
But probably not without a fight. Hands recently ruffled feathers inside the company. He implied in a memo that the label's artists weren't pulling their weight. Aram Sinreich is a partner at Radar Research. He says the cost-conscious Hands risks alienating both staff and talent.
The potential upside, of course, is that by bringing costs down, that will allow EMI to be a more attractive target for acquisition or mergers in the future. But the potential downside is that they're going to scare all of the artists and all of the major executive talent out of the company before they can do that.
EMI already lost its biggest name earlier this year. Radiohead reportedly wanted $10 million to sign a new contract. EMI offered $3 million, and Radiohead walked. It's not yet clear who won that battle. The band released its latest album without the support of a traditional label. The CD comes out tomorrow. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
As the falling ball lights Times Square tonight, the lights will effectively be going out at the Federal Election Commission. The FEC is going to start the new year with only two commissioners. There are six of them usually. Official votes need a quorum of at least four. Staffers are still tracking campaign finances as usual. But Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports only commissioners can stop candidates from bending the rules.
Who turned out the lights at the FEC? Point the finger at Congress and the White House. President Bush sent his FEC nominees to the Senate for approval. Congress isn't thrilled with his choices. The White House won't budge. The result?
It could be very much a Wild West election.
What will our favorite campaign cowhands get up to? Massey Rich of the Center for Responsive Politics says politicians in legal trouble may use campaign cash in creative ways.
Given the behavior of some of these politicians and how they use their campaign money, I wouldn't be surprised if they went ahead and just started paying their lawyers with their contributors' money anyway.
And can a company flying a blimp plastered with Ron Paul's name accept unlimited contributions? For Steve Weissman of the Campaign Finance Institute, the big unanswered question is,
who's a lobbyist? Who has to report if they're going around raising money for candidates?
Weissman says now candidates might not get an answer until after the presidential election, when it doesn't matter. But attorney Paul Ryan of the Campaign Legal Center says even the fully staffed FEC is never speedy.
And instead, it takes the commission many months, usually several years, before they announce anything having to do with an investigation of alleged wrongdoing.
Weissman of the Campaign Finance Institute says both parties like their creative accounting, so neither is anxious to speed up FEC investigations. And they're not in a big hurry to get new commissioners in place either. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Traders sold in their rush to get to the parties tonight, but all in all, Wall Street came out ahead this year. Pretty good amount, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The search for a solution to illegal immigration fundamentally comes down to one of two approaches. The first is to go after the supply side, that is, stopping immigrants from coming here. The other is what you might call the demand side, going after companies that need the labor those immigrants supply. In Arizona, an estimated 1 in 10 workers is undocumented. That's double the national average. It's also the reason the nation's toughest demand-side immigration law will go into effect there tomorrow. It could eventually become a national model for how to deal with illegal immigration if Arizona doesn't go bankrupt first. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Arizona's new law punishes businesses that knowingly hire illegal immigrants. Two violations and a company's business license can be revoked, effectively shutting it down. Sheridan Bailey runs Iron Co., a steel beam manufacturer in Phoenix. About half of his 100 workers are immigrants. He says without them, his company would go under. Bailey says he's already fired several workers in anticipation of the employer sanctions law. The rest are on notice. Come January 1st, the dragnet is out.
It creates an air of insecurity, uncertainty, and doubt about the workers who we are trying to motivate to be productive. It's a toxic situation.
Last year, Bailey raised the wage for steel fitters to $20 an hour, well above his competitors. But even that didn't convince more native-born workers to take up a blowtorch in Arizona's 112-degree heat.
We're scouring the neighborhoods. We're talking to ex-offenders. We're going to American vets, and we're spending lots of money and time and attention. But it's not enough to solve the problem.
Bailey says he recently signed a deal to outsource some production to Mexico. Arizona, like the rest of the nation, is facing high energy prices, a housing downturn, and an impending recession. Dan Griswold's with the Cato Institute.
Imagine the consequences to the business sector of Arizona if they not only have 10% of their workers in jeopardy of being chased out of the state, but if thousands of them are in jeopardy of losing their business license. This is a kind of economic suicide.
So why do it? Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano said on KJZZ FM in Phoenix that she signed the bill to set an example for the nation.
This bill is designed to deal with the demand side of this immigration equation. And by doing so, I think it will illuminate, not just for Arizonans, but for the rest of the country, what the stakes in this immigration debate really are.
Economists say that Arizona, by acting first, has put its economy on the line. Judy Gans is with the University of Arizona.
When a state takes it on, then it puts itself at a competitive disadvantage relative to other states. Then you end up shrinking the economy because needed workers aren't available.
Gans found that Arizona's immigrants, legal and illegal, contribute $44 billion in economic output. That's 12% of the economy. And that's what may be at stake when the sanctions law takes effect January 1st. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
A year ago, shares of Apple were trading at about $85 a share. They closed today a tad under $200 a piece. Not bad for a computer company that's got less than 10% of the PC market, I'd say. Except, of course, Apple's not really a computer company anymore. The rise of the iPod saw to that, and the iPhone, of course, is at the top of almost everybody's gadgets of the year list. So it's a great place to start a look back at the year of the phone. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli is here to do that with us. Lisa, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm all right. But let me ask you this. Obviously, the iPhone is the phone of the year, if I could, you know, turn my phrases around. But I don't have an iPhone. You don't have an iPhone. A whole lot of people out there don't have an iPhone. So why does the iPhone matter?
Well, unless you live here in Hollywood, Kai, only about 1.5 million people have bought these iPhones. Here, everybody seems to have sprouted one. They haven't dominated the market, but what they've done is they've changed expectations. Even if you just see an iPhone once, you can see this whole promise that we've been hearing about for the last few years of the computer moving mobile. It's sexy. And it works. And so it's raised the bar for what the rest of us are going to want in our phones coming down the road. And it's been a petri dish for all the services, the merge services, the phone, the music, the internet access on one device.
All right. Well, let's move away from the sexy hardware for just a second and talk a little bit about the changes that the iPhone has wrought. How has the mobile industry changed this year?
Well, more and more people aren't bothering with landlines. Now it's up to 13.5%. And if you're under the age of 25, 25% of all people don't even bother with a landline anymore. This business gets bigger and bigger every day. It's a $134 billion business. And still, we all hate our cell phone providers.
Right. So let me just get you where you're going, which is none of us really are incredibly happy unless we spend $500 on an iPhone. We're not happy with the phones. What is the industry going to do? What's it going to take to make us happy?
Well, even when you spend the $500 on your iPhone, mad at AT&T half the time, but you still love your hardware. What it's going to take is what's starting to happen and what started to happen in the last half of this year. It's the coming down of the walls. There's more competition coming down the road. So places like Verizon have recognized that they have to sort of appease you a little bit. So they've just announced a little while ago that they're going to bring down the wall. You could buy any phone you want starting late next year and use it on the Verizon platform. Little subtle changes in contracts where they still lock you in forever when you make a change, but they don't lock you in as badly as they've been locking you in the past. All of those little changes are adding up to a more consumer-friendly phone environment, and ultimately that's going to mean more competition and more service for you and me.
One hopes, anyway. All right. We started with a big name. Let me end our little chat here with a big name, Google. I mean, obviously it's the 800-pound gorilla of a whole bunch of things, but it is now in the phone business.
Right. So we talked about Apple every day last year when it came to the phone. This year we're going to talk about Google and the phone, because in a couple of weeks, a huge spectrum of airwaves is coming up for grabs from the government. And Google is leading the charge of businesses that are clamoring to fork down money for these airwaves. What these airwaves are going to do is bring cell phone service up to the next level. And Google wants a piece of that action. And they're trying to change the rules about the way those airwaves are auctioned off. And as they often do, they're going to have an impact.
How do you feel about your phone?
I have a crummy old pink Razr phone that was very glam
which,
when
like
I bought it.
3 years ago, it was the hippest thing ever.
And that's not why I bought it. I bought
yeah,
it
sure.
because – no, no. I bought it because it was cheap. It was on a Mother's Day special. Even though I'm not a mother, I got a $29 pink Razr phone. I hate it. If I could turn off the phone and just have social interaction with people face-to-face, I'd be a very happy woman. But I live in 2008, so I can't.
Lisa Napoli covers technology and a whole bunch of other stuff for us. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, it's a 2007 speak and spell for business jargon. Try this one on. Ninja, N-I-N-J-A.
No income, no job or assets. That's sort of the subbest of the subprime, I guess you would call it.
But first, let's do the NUMBERSs. The Dow ended the day down 0.75%, 101 points on nagging economic worries, closing the year at 13,264. The NASDAQ lost 0.8%, 22 points, came to rest at 2652. The S&P 500 sank 0.2%, 10 points, wrapped up the year at 1468. You'd almost think all those long months of subprime mortgage woes and credit market turmoil never, ever happened, looking at the stock market's performance for the whole year. The Dow average was up 6.4%, with the biggest drag, a 47% loss by Citigroup, of all companies. The NASDAQ enjoyed its best year since 2003, advancing 9.8% January through December. That was even better than the broader S&P 500, which climbed just 3.5% over the past 12 months. Keep in mind, though, that all three major indices suffered losses in the last quarter of the year gone by. Bond prices rose, sending the yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 4.03%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday, the first day of the year. No trading for the holiday. U.S. financial markets, as well as others around the world, are closed. Happy birthday, J.D. Salinger. The author will be 89. And 2.5 hours sitting on the couch watching the Tournament of Roses parade is a quiet way to recover from New Year's Eve. This year's theme is Passport to the World Celebrations. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Happy New Year.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We all know that China has become a manufacturing powerhouse, but when it comes to producing management talent, the country still relies on imports from the United States. Bill Marcus has more now from Shanghai.
Experienced managers and creative innovators jump frequently from job to job. And when they do, their salaries typically jump 20 to 30% on average. China pretty much cranks out whatever it wants at a fraction of the price of its competitors. So why not management material? According to management recruiter Peter Sickness, a key reason is China's rote and repeat education system.
value analyze, and make decisions. I mean, that is one of the biggest gaps that we find with managers. They're great at, let's say, receiving directives and effecting the directives. Very difficult to find good people that can make decisions, can evaluate, and make sound decisions.
A study reported by Businessweek compared the emotional intelligence of American and Chinese CEOs. It found while Chinese managers can carry out orders very efficiently, they have trouble thinking creatively and independently. Now China is trying to jumpstart spontaneity, but it's not easy.
All right, let's start. Good morning. How's everybody today?
That's OTI Consulting's Daniel Liu. He's one of an army of trainers companies hire to transform the stiff, formal entrepreneurs into something closer to a glad-handing, gregarious, rotary-type member.
One, two, three, let's go.
Here he pushes a class full of salespeople to do something way out of their comfort zone. For 31-year-old Gloria Gu, this couldn't be further from the Confucian Ask No Questions classroom that she grew up in.
We have material, and the teacher taught, and we just listen to or just do the work all by ourselves, something like that. It's totally different.
Jason Walker is a consultant with the Executive Learning Center. He helps train managers to overcome rigid thinking.
Teachers do not necessarily push or challenge students to explore ideas, to probe deeper, to ask why, to find out the implications of what they've just learned. How does that? What's the next step? What does that affect?
But at Bloom Outsourcing, CEO Eric Rongley says China is producing plenty of book-smart managers and engineers. They're just not teaching them how to apply their knowledge.
They're taught how much the hammer weighs, what are the dimensions of the hammer, what does the metal consist of, and all of the properties of the hammer, but they've never hit a nail with the hammer.
Executive search expert Peter Sickness says China recognizes there's a problem and is trying to fix it without losing face.
Part of the social fabric, the culture here, is the fear of failure, of being seen as a failure. So oftentimes these efforts are being done. Again, quietly, because in case it doesn't work, they don't want to be embarrassed.
But people skills are tougher to mass develop than widgets. And even if China is successful at developing inquisitive leaders, some worry the flip side just might be a class of managers willing to question the establishment. In Shanghai, I'm Bill Marcus for Marketplace.
The news about business and the economy this year has been generally lousy, but it's been a pretty good time to be in business journalism. Because when you start using words like dead cat bounce and exploding arm, you just know people are going to start paying attention. We called Joe Pickett to review the year in business with him. He's the executive editor of the American Heritage Dictionary. Carry trade was on the top of his list of words of the year. We throw it around here at the office all the time, you know, just because we can. But we asked Joe for a layman's definition.
The borrowing of currencies or commodities at favorable interest rates in order to invest in higher yielding assets.
Unless you're actually in the foreign exchange business, I'd say that's pretty much all you need to know about the carry trade. But it did prompt the question of whether Mr. Pickett ever happens on words that are just too complicated.
Sometimes. And in those cases, quite often, we'll ask an expert for help. But, yeah, there have been a few where we've decided this is so complicated or so obscure that there's no way, if we can't explain it to a reader, there's no point in putting it in the book. So,
yeah. When you're trying to come up with this list of words, and I don't know what the collegiality factor is amongst dictionary editors, but do you ever call the folks at, Merriam-Webster's and say, are you guys using this word?
No, it's a very competitive business. We never do that, even though a lot of us know each other and like each other and we belong to the same organizations and see each other. We don't talk about that kind of thing at all.
How do words get on this list?
Well, we pay attention to what's going on in the business world by listening to shows like yours and reading the Wall Street Journal and other publications.
Are there restrictions on how a word is formed? I mean, if you have a compound or a thing where you add a suffix or a prefix, does that make it a new word?
Yeah, if it's a existing word plus a suffix, and that's quite often the way we make new words, or a compound, like, say, collateralized debt obligation.
We try to stay away from that word on the program.
Yeah, it's kind of a mouthful. But when we see that, then it's a new word, and we put it in as a new word.
What's your very favorite on the list this year, if you had to pick one?
Oh, gee. I guess ninja.
Yeah.
No income, no job or assets. Oh, that's sort of the subest of the subprime, I guess you would call it.
All right, so not to spring a pop quiz on you, but let's go down this list that you sent us of some of these words. Alphabetical order would be fine. Clawback, what the heck is that?
Well, that's a provision. So if you're an investor in a venture capital firm and suddenly the management is making a huge amount of money, these investors want to get a share of that, and it's considered a clawback. This is a very old term, actually, but it evokes a kind of jungle of the investing world where it's a kind of Darwinian struggle.
This one doesn't even sound like a word. It's probably some shortening or sort of vernacular here. RELO, R-E-L-O?
Oh, yeah, that's an old term in the real estate business for relocation, and it refers to relocating business people in new markets and trying to find them homes. But then they referred to people as relos and deals as relos. This is a relo deal. So it's an interesting clipping. And usually words that are clipped like that have an informal air to them. So another example of that is merch for merchandise. And they're used by people in the business itself originally, but then quite often they become so well known that the general public gets to use them too.
Do you guys do a word of the year, a business word of the year, or anything like that?
We don't do that as a kind of official thing, but I would have to say for 2007, it's got to be subprime because it's a word that's really not in any general dictionary, and it's one of these words that had existed for a while and pops up from obscurity and on the front page of the newspaper every day now. And it's something that is not going to go away anytime soon either. So we're pretty confident that that's a big word for 2007.
Joe Pickett is the executive editor of the American Heritage Dictionary. Mr. Pickett, thanks a lot for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note of 2007, lots of us are going to tune in to watch the ball drop in Times Square tonight. People all over the world do it. But tonight is special. The ball drop turns 100 this year. And to celebrate, a couple of new elements have been added. For one, the ball itself is more environmentally friendly. This year's version is made with almost 9,600 energy-efficient bulbs. Also tonight, for the first time, the confetti that rains down on all those revelers standing in the cold and the dark there in Times Square, it's going to include tiny little printed personal wishes for the new year. 70,000 people offered their thoughts. We sadly missed the deadline, but still, all the best to all of you. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media for this Monday and for the year of 2007. Today, the Dow lost 101 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ fell 22 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 dipped 10 points, that is 0.2%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, are you hoping for new primetime shows in 2008? Yeah, me too, but don't hold your breath.
We're going to be pretty much at the bottom of the cupboard, I would say probably by March.
Excellent. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.